very pleased to have Evelyn, who's come from Brussels, to tell us about quantum theory and the definition of structure.
Thank you, Matt, and especially I would like to thank Lucy and Hardy for the invitation. It's been really fun. So I'm going to talk about some attempts to reformulate quantum theory in a way that does not presume time or causal structure from the outset, inspired by operational insights. So I'll be speaking about work that I've done with different collaborators in different contexts, and particularly Charles Bruckner, Nicolas Serre, Fabio Costa, and Cristina Giarmazzi. So as you're all, I suppose, very well familiar, the standard formulation of quantum theory, which is in terms of states that undergo transformations in time, which we measure and update the state and so forth, assumes time to begin with. And this is somehow a conceptual problem when it comes to the quest for unified theory, which unifies quantum mechanics and gravity, where we expect that, similarly to general relativity, the causal structure of space-time would be dynamical, possibly uncertain in a quantum way, just like other observables. And this is the main motivation for this kind of work. And I've been inspired a lot by this so-called operational approach to quantum theory, which has been pioneered by Lucy and Hardy in the early 2000s. And a lot of work has been done. A lot of insights have been gained into the structure of quantum theory following this approach, where basically, we view quantum theory as a theory that prescribes probabilities for events that ultimately have a classical description. And these events, they are associated with specific laboratory procedures, such as preparations, transformations, and measurements. And there has been a lot of success, actually, in reconstructing the Hilbert space formalism from informational principles within this framework. But even in this most abstract approach, there is still this assumption of a temporal sequence, like a preparation precedes a transformation, which precedes a measurement, and so forth. Similarly, there is a whole branch of quantum foundations and quantum information deals with studying the space-like correlations that quantum theory permits. As you know, they violate Bell inequalities and so forth. And again, in this paradigm, the causal structure of space-time is assumed from the outside. And this raises various questions. In particular, can we understand this notion of causal structure from some more primitive operational concepts, like we've been able to understand the Hilbert space formalism, for example? Could it be, for example, that, let's say, rather than saying signaling is only possible from one event into the future light cone, instead we consider the correlations between two local experiments, and if there is a signaling from A to B, we say that A is in the past of B, for example, or something else to that effect. And why should signaling always go forward in time? What does it actually mean to signal, really? And more ambitiously, can we generalize quantum theory such that we don't assume any of these concepts, but rather understand them to arise, as I said, from more operational primitives, but also perhaps we permit these more general possibilities that we expect in the context of quantum gravity, such as indefinite causal structures, for example? And obviously, what kind of new physical or information processing capabilities would such a more general framework entail is a very important question. So in this talk, it's basically divided in roughly into three, but I would rather say two parts. And the first part is what we call the process framework. It's an attempt to relax the assumption that local operations, as we normally assume, take place in a particular order. So it's a framework in which quantum theory is only assumed locally, but still a certain notion of causality locally is presumed. And then this theory, which I will outline and will describe some recent results in it, it's still carries over some notion of causal structure, as I said, locally, and in particular, it is time asymmetric, and I'm going to then later address the concept of time reversal symmetry, and we'll propose how we might actually formulate in informational terms using concepts such as events and probabilities, a theory which is fundamentally time symmetric, and then unifying these at the end, we obtain a kind of formulation of quantum theory, which is slightly more general than the usual one, because it permits more general things, as we'll see, in which no prior notion of time is assumed, not even locally. So this process matrix framework is this abstract paradigm in which we imagine local experiments, as I said, but we don't assume that there is any particular order between them. We don't assume that they take place in space-time, for example. In particular, you know, that we take this primitive notion of an experiment, which the simplest one we can think of is one with an input and an output system, such that to permit us to establish, to reproduce the correlations that we can conceive in space-time. For example, we would like to be able to capture situations in which Alice can send a signal to Bob, who is in the future, and that's why we permit both input and output systems. And basically, the paradigm, you should think of it like this. I mean, imagine that there is a particular experimenter, Alice. She resides inside a sealed laboratory, and at a given instant, she receives some physical system, maybe a quantum system, maybe we are in some more generalized theory than quantum theory. And on this system, she can perform different operations using the devices in her laboratory. In particular, she chooses a setting, which is how to set up the device, and the device spits out some classical outcome labeled by O, and then this might transform the system, and some transformed system is being sent out of the laboratory. And similarly for Bob and Charlie, and we can conceive of many parties that operate in these settings. And the main assumption is that basically each of these parties exchanges information with the outside world only through the input and output systems. So, for instance, speaking intuitively, I mean, if Alice is to receive information, if we assume that information can only come from the past, we expect that she will be able to receive information only through this input system and to send out information only through whatever she sends out of the output of her laboratory. Now, this is the general paradigm. We assume nothing about any particular order or existence of such an order between the laboratories. And in considering the joint probabilities for different possible outcomes that they might obtain given their settings, and consider this list of probabilities, this catalog, we call this a process. It's like an extension of the notion of a quantum state, where a quantum state, you can think of it in similar terms, but you're only doing measurements on an input system that comes from the past, so to say. But we're interested specifically here in this talk. For most of it, I'll talk about the quantum version of it. So we'll assume that inside these local laboratories, physics is described by quantum theory. So in particular, we imagine that, let's say, Alice, her input system is associated with some Hilbert space, H1, and the output system is associated with some other Hilbert space. And the most general transformation, or the most general operation that actually she can perform from this input to the output system is given by what is often called a quantum instrument or simply a quantum operation, where each different outcome, here labeled by J, it corresponds to some completely positive map from the space of operators over the input Hilbert space to the space of the operators over the output Hilbert space. A completely positive map, as you probably are well familiar, I mean, can be written in this Krauss form, for example, when it acts on a particular input density matrix or any operator, can be expressed like this, where these are the Krauss operators. And there is this additional condition that a quantum operation is such a thing that the different possible outcomes, when we sum up over them, when we sum up the completely positive maps, we obtain what's called a completely positive and trace preserving map. And this actually corresponds to the following condition. Basically, it means that if I ignore the outcome, I mean, if I were to apply this on some, my instrument on some input density matrix, it is going to output a valid normalized density matrix. Now, this is our main assumption, that that basically, when you have a bunch of different parties, Alice, Bob, Charlie, and so forth, and they perform these operations, just like it is the case in space-time, when we have a space-time configuration of different experiments, the joint probabilities for their experiments are going to be functions only of the local completely positive maps that describe the respective local outcomes. In other words, the joint probabilities are non-contextual functions. They depend only on the particular description of the completely positive map and not on what other possible completely positive maps might have happened or anything like that. And now the local validity of quantum theory, which means tells us in particular what happens, if how to describe operations if we randomize them, if we randomize our choices, or if we coarse grain outcomes, and so forth, can be seen to imply that this probability must be a linear function of these CP maps. So if you think of it as a function of such CP maps here, or just some maps, it's a linear function. And this suggests a very simple way of describing such linear function. Actually, we will use the Choi isomorphism to represent completely positive maps. This is one very convenient choice, which reduces to known representations, as we'll see in a moment. Basically, the Choi isomorphism allows us to write down every completely positive map from this space to that space as a positive semi-definite matrix on the tensor product of these two spaces. So how this matrix is given is like this. I mean, you take an unnormalized maximally entangled state on two copies of the input system. You apply on one of them your completely positive map, and this yields some kind of state. It's unnormalized. It's a convention how we choose to normalize this. And this positive semi-definite operator that you get on the tensor product of the input and output Hilbert spaces is the Choi matrix. Well, in terms of this data, we can write down any linear function in this form. I mean, it's very easy to see that if you have a linear function on the individual CP maps, we represent them like that by this positive semi-definite matrices. I mean, we obtain, most generally, we can write such a linear function in the form of some trace of some operator with the tensor product of the local CP maps. And this is what we call process matrix, because it is the encodes basically the process, the correlations that I was talking at the beginning. You can think of it as a generalization of the density matrix in some sense. This is very similar to Born's rule, where here, for example, you might have your measurement operators on a joint state, but it permits signaling. This is an extension of the state. It's an extension of the density matrix, which, as we'll see in a moment, allows us to describe correlations in space-time. In particular, how does signaling enter in this picture? Well, I mean, if these were just measurements on a joint quantum state, if these were some measurement operators, I mean, the sum of the different measurement operators is always the identity, right, when you speak about measurements. And in that case, this implies that basically independent, no matter what choice of measurement Alice makes, the probabilities for the outcomes of Bob, for example, are the same. They are totally independent. But here we see the possibility that different choices can affect actually the probabilities for the outcome of Bob. And this is because the sum of the different completely positive maps doesn't need to be the identity. It can be some other completely positive map expressed here. So in addition, we make a few other, actually we would like this expression to describe valid probabilities. And we make another assumption, because we are interested in really extending quantum theory just by relaxing the assumption of a global causal structure. We assume that the parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, they can share arbitrary quantum states as permitted by standard quantum theory, because a quantum state is a non-signaling resource, and it's naturally compatible with different causal orders. I mean, we can conceive of situations in which Alice is before Bob in some experiment, but nevertheless, I mean, they could share an ancilla in a valid quantum state. So we assume that. And then this assumption plus the requirement that probabilities are non-negative implies that this matrix that I showed here is positive semi-definite. But okay, it cannot be just any positive semi-definite matrix. We require that whenever, when we sum up over the different possible outcomes, this gives these are valid probabilities, and so we obtain one. So the probabilities sum up to one. And this means that whenever I plug in here a completely positive and trace preserving map in each of these places, we get one. So whenever these are CPTP maps, and there are conditions on the Choi matrix to say when a particular Choi matrix represents a completely positive and trace preserving map, this should be one. And actually, this can be used to characterize the set of all possible process matrices. They can be characterized very conveniently using a Hilbert-Schmidt expansion, but I will not go into these details. I'll just show a few examples. For instance, the case in which we imagine that a state is prepared in the past, two systems in a joint quantum state, and one system is given to Alice, the other to Bob, after which they operate and discard the system. This is given like this. We just have the density matrix at the input systems, A1 and B1, and then we have identity on the outputs where the system is discarded. Or for example, we can consider this, some state is prepared, a system is prepared in the state role, which is given to Bob. After he operates, maybe his output system goes through some quantum channel into Alice. She operates in the future, and we discard her output system. This is given like this, where here we have the Choi operator of the channel.
Does it contain some geometric in their internal structure?
Well, the structure, okay, as I said, they are by definition those that obey these constraints. And we have found that there are all these which are positive semi-definite and in an expansion in a specific Hilbert-Schmidt basis contain certain types of terms. I didn't include a slide because I didn't want to overwhelm you with this. But yes, I mean, you can think abstractly as this set of matrices. It's a convex set which obeys these constraints. And there are ways to characterize it. One is in this Hilbert-Schmidt decomposition. But I didn't include. I can show you later. Actually, a more general thing you might imagine. And actually, it turns out that this is the most general situation in which you have no signaling from Bob to Alice. Is the following. You prepare, let's say, some joint system. You give part of it to Alice. After she operates, you recombine the two systems, run them through some joint channel, and send this to Bob. This is given by this form. More generally, the most general process matrix that obeys the previous constraints that I said, which has this form, actually has a realization like this. And it is the most general process matrix in which we have no signaling from Bob to Alice. And if you think about causality now, if you think about different situations in which these experiments might be embedded in a causal space-time, I mean, you see that indeed, in any possible causal configurations, at least one party cannot signal to the other, right? Because they are, for example, they are space-like separated, or one is in the future. The one that is in the future is not supposed to be able to send the signal to the past. And this. You know, the one that is more generally compatible with some causal configuration, fixed one between the parties, is this. And it has a realization in practice. This has been proven by Kiribella, Dariano, and Perinotti in a separate work. So we see now that we have these process matrices, which are compatible with causality. In particular, I'll use this notation to say that Alice is not before Bob in some causal structure. So Alice does not precede Bob, meaning that in this case, obviously, there is no possibility for signaling from Alice to Bob. And as I said, this is most generally what we call a channel with memory. This is, we call this realization channel with memory. A channel with memory from Bob to Alice. And similarly, the other most general thing we might conceive is a channel with memory from Bob to Alice. But this is if there is a particular location of Alice and Bob in a causal structure, which is fixed and known. But we might even consider situations in which, with some probability, Alice happens to be before Bob, and with another probability, Bob is before Alice, or something like that. So we may imagine that at random, we realize one of these possible scenarios. So this is also a process matrix that should be compatible with causality, right? We can realize it, at least in this way, by tossing a coin and realizing one of these two possibilities in space-time. So this should be considered causal, and this seems to be the most general bipartite scenario that we might actually think of. We call this causally separable. At this level, it is really kind of not strictly rigorous, but it is intuitive because we say it's either one or the other. Maybe we don't know, and we can think of a way of implementing this. So it's natural to ask, is this set that we discussed, the set of process matrices composed only of this kind of matrices that obey causality? So are all these possible Ws that arise in the framework causally separable? The answer is actually no. And this can be shown with a very striking example. It turns out that there are correlations that can be established within this framework that are impossible to realize in any causal structure with any theory, in fact. And here is an example. Imagine the following game. We give Alice and Bob one random bit each. A is given to Alice and B is given to Bob. These are privately given to them. And the goal is for them to communicate to each other. So intuitively, we would like to exploit the fact that if there is a causal configuration, some causal order between the parties, I mean, we can have either signaling from Alice to Bob or signaling from Bob to Alice, but not in both directions. So we introduce this additional bit, B prime here, which randomly is going to tell Bob whether the goal will be that Bob sends a signal to Alice or he receives a signal from Alice. In other words, we will look at the following. If B prime is equal to zero, we look at the probability that the guess, so Alice performs an operation and she outputs some guess for X. The guess of Alice is equal to this bit that was given to Bob. In other words, there was a signaling. Bob was able to communicate the bit to Alice. Or if B prime is equal to one, we look at the other. We look for the other correlation. We want Alice's, Bob's guess to be equal to Alice. And it's very easy to see that if there is a causal order between the parties, there is a bound on this possible probability of success. Simply because, as I said, either one is in the path of the other or the other is in the path of the first. Or they are space-like separated. But there can be no signaling in both directions. You can only signal from the past to the future, which means that I can at most satisfy this to be one. I could perhaps have perfect signaling from Bob to Alice. But in that case, I would have no signaling from Alice to Bob if this is the configuration. So this can be at most one half. The best would be just a random guess of the other party. So this gives us 1 + 1/2. And this is 1/2 for the probability of the different bits. It's 3/4. And it turns out that the process framework contains process matrices that allows us to be this. And we obtain something like that. I mean, I don't give the details here, but with this process matrix, where these are two-level systems, this is a valid process matrix, we can achieve similarly a violation similar to the CHSH violation of a Bell inequality. So there is some analogy here with Bell inequalities. And yeah, it turns out that this is possible. And you can see the details in the paper. So now the question is, does this describe anything that can be realized in nature somehow? I mean, intuitively, you might say no, obviously, because at least in the familiar regimes of quantum mechanics, we have a clear causal structure. Everything happens at a given location, so there is a causal order. I mean, obviously, this should be something beyond. But even this is not so obvious, I should say, because, I mean, a priori, this is not in the possibility to achieve such processes is not necessarily incompatible with the idea of the fact that we can describe evolution in time by some causal unitary dynamics, because it might be that I have an experiment where from the site, I have a description of everything going on by some unitary transformation, but in some sense, inside that experiment, there might be a way to see this as involving different local experiments which somehow happen in superposition of different times or something like that, some kind of they might not have definite times, these local experiments.
The possible morphism is that restrict some structural properties on those W transformations.
Actually, I mean, in some sense, first of all, we don't know whether we can do that, at least for those process matrices. But in principle, any of these Ws in a particular sense is embeddable in a unitary. Simply because if you think about it, I mean, you might imagine the settings and outcomes of Alice and Bob to model them also coming on the site as quantum systems, like this, for example. Like, I mean, using, roughly speaking, some schematic representation like this, you might imagine, okay, these are the settings and outcomes of Alice. This is the input system of Alice. This goes, I mean, you can write a kind of circuit diagram in this form, more or less, to describe the correlations. And in principle, what we have here is, you know, this is a some transformation from these inputs to these outputs. And it is a completely positive and trace preserving. So in principle, it can be considered part of some larger thing. However, the tricky question is, how can I interpret really? I mean, I can always embed this and perform in the lab some unitary which reproduces these correlations.
Yeah,
But how can I argue that I really have a situation in which I have a local operation of Alice in some sense, as well as a local operation of Bob? So that is not quite decided yet.
The operation of meaning of like this extension to larger space is not always clear.
Yes, it is. We don't know for the moment, at least, how to, in some sensible operational way, interpret such a experiment, which is just a trivial unitary somehow, as representing what I was describing, which is the motivation for this framework. But in principle, there are others where we can say something. Like, for instance, this quantum switch, this is a super operation of two local operations, A and B, which was proposed by Kilibella, Dariano, Perinotti, and Valiron. It's in this higher order computational paradigm that they consider. But I mean, it can be translated to our language. And one way to think, what it is conditionally on a control bit, which could be a quantum bit in superposition, we would like to apply the operations A and B in two possible orders. If the bit is zero, or if the bit is one, I would like to apply first A and then B. If it is zero, I would like to apply first B and then A. One possible realization might be like this. I'm going to apply the operation B on some system, on my system here at a given time, but conditionally on whether this is zero or one, I'm going to apply this. Let's imagine that it's unitary for the moment. I'm going to apply it either here or here. And then I can send all these things to Charlie. Now, if you think that in some sense, there is this single operation of Alice that is happening, maybe at a time which is indefinite, then we can actually calculate what this process matrix is. And it can be shown that this process matrix is not causally separable in a sense that I actually haven't yet defined for the tripartite case, but I will mention it later. And in other words, it cannot be understood as describing definite scenarios in which I have a quantum causal connection between A, B, and C. Nevertheless, it turns out that it cannot violate any causal inequality. Anything that you can construct with this thing cannot violate causal inequalities like the one I was describing before. So, but nevertheless, in some theory-dependent and device-dependent sense, you can argue that it is describes something that goes beyond definite causality. Okay, but I'll leave this at a kind of non-rigorous statement. I'm just saying that at the moment, we do not have a definite answer, but it's a possibility that such a thing might actually be realizable in some well-defined sense. But we need to develop this sense. I should say that a lot of causal inequalities have been found beyond the one I was describing. Like, for example, there is a simple inequality with just a single bit given to each party and a single bit as an output. One thing that I would like to highlight is what was shown very interesting by Baumeller and Wolf is that actually you may not even have locally quantum mechanics. You might just restrict to diagonal operations, like locally classical probabilistic theory. And nevertheless, in the tripartite case or n-partite cases, you can violate causal inequalities. In the bipartite case, this is not possible. In our original paper, we show that if you have a bipartite process and you restrict to diagonal operations, the process will be causally separable and it will obey any conceivable causal inequality. But it turns out this is not the case for multipartite scenarios. And so this raises various questions. I mean, do we really understand what causality means? How do we define these things? Actually, I'll just mention here some recent work that we have done with Cristina Giarmazzi, whose goal is to basically develop a rigorous theory of the notion of causality in this framework. Because so far, most of these arguments that I gave about causal inequalities and so forth, they are correct, but somehow they do not arise from a general definition of causality, which is appropriate for this process framework. And so we have developed here a theory of causality and what I was using kind of heuristically, this causal separability, causally separable processes and other things. So a notion of causality, I mean, why do I say that we didn't have a proper definition of that? Because the notion of causality should have a universal expression. I mean, you would like it to be something like a principle, more or less. You would like it to sound like causality. You would like, first of it, you would like it to be something out of which you can derive what are the possible causal correlations between any number of parties. So it should apply for the multipartite case. But then in the multipartite case, there is a funny thing that is possible, which is compatible with our intuition of causality. And this is what I call dynamical causal order, meaning that, for example, you can conceive situations where we have three parties, for instance, and Alice is first, and depending on what she does in her laboratory, Bob and Charlie might receive their input systems in different order in the future. So this is totally compatible with what we believe causality should be about, right? Because what happens now might influence the order in which two events happen in the future. So this possibility of dynamical causal order should be also part of the notion of causality. But this already means that a priori the causal order between parties is something that might depend on the settings of the parties in general. So how to formulate it is not absolutely straightforward. And I mean, of course, whatever we formulate and call it causality, it better kind of reflects our intuition of causality somehow. So we have proposed the following. I mean, first of all, what is the intuition that we would like to capture? Well, I think in this framework in which we imagine that locally we have settings and outcomes, that is, we have this idea of an agent choosing the setting and doing different things by this choice. The idea is that the setting that Alice, for example, chooses in her lab can only affect events in the future. In other words, it should not affect what happens in the causal past or the space-like separated or causally independent regions. Neither should it affect the causal order of events that might have happened in the past or in these regions. So this is the intuition that we want. We want the probability for a set of events to occur outside of the future light cone, so to say, of the causal future of Alice, to be independent of her setting, as well as their causal configuration and the relative causal configuration with Alice too should be independent of what Alice chooses to do. This is the idea that this choice is somehow free and can only affect things in the future. And this can be formulated. I mean, it's not very easy to read this expression, but pretty much it is formalizing this idea. We're saying that for any, if you consider Alice and consider any subset of the rest of the parties in our joint experiment, we say that the process is causal if there exists a random partial order. So the causal order is a partial order, right? So, we can say something is before something else. This gives an order, but sometimes things are space-like separated, so an order is not defined there. So if there exists a partial order with the following properties, we basically require that the probability for particular configuration of, well, I'm just going to interpret it for you because it might be a little confusing staring at this. Basically, this is capturing the intuition that the probability for outcomes of parties who are not in the future of Alice, as well as for their causal configuration, which is induced by this global causal configuration, is independent of the setting of Alice.
What is the difference between random partial order and partial order?
Well, here I permit it to be random in the sense that I permit it to, I allow to, well, like you can call it just partial, just partial order.
So you just mean that there is any partial order, yeah? Or you put some extra condition on this?
There is a partial order, yes, but there is a probability. So there are probabilities for different possible partial orders depending on the settings. So this is it's a random variable which may depend on the settings. So you might just call it there exists a partial order. But when I say there exists a partial order, it seems to me that, okay, it exists and it has a particular value, this partial order. Alice is before Bob, or this is independent of Charlie, and that's it. But here I'm saying, you know, this might actually depend. Like, as I said, whatever Alice does might influence the order in which Bob and Charlie operate in the future. So a priori, I permit the partial order of the three parties to be a function of the settings. Well, maybe this is another way to say that it's a partial order, which is a function of the settings. But I'm talking about probabilities. Everything here is a random variable. So I'd like to highlight here that, okay, although it is hard to read, if one stares at it for a sufficiently long time, one can appreciate, I think. And one of the one of the features of this definition is that it gives us a background independent understanding of partial order. I mean, I just introduced partial order as a hypothetical, I introduced causal order as a hypothetical partial order that might exist between these events. And the only constraints that I imposed on it just concern the correlations between these events. It should have a particular, it should respect a particular constraint. So I don't refer to any background, like I don't need to introduce any space in with certain structures in which I should position Alice and Bob. No, I just have the local experiments, and the causal order is a relation on them, is this partial order relation on them, which obeys specific properties. And there might be more than one possible causal interpretations. So we might imagine, you know, for example, you have no signaling between Alice and Bob. This is compatible with Alice being before Bob, compatible with them being space-like separated or anything. All right, so here I think I'm going to skip a little bit some of the details, but basically starting from that kind of formulation of the idea that Alice cannot influence things outside of her causal future, we might actually now derive conditions on what a causal process actually is, speaking entirely in terms of settings and outcomes, not even assuming quantum theory. And for this, we need to introduce a lot of language, which I'll skip, basically things like conditional process and so reduced process and so forth. Well, basically, if you have no signaling from, imagine a multipartite process. The process, just say, is just the collection of disjoint probabilities. I can consider the separating the parties into two groups. One I call A and the other I call B, like these ones, for example. Now, if the joint probabilities in describing this process are such that I have no signaling from B to A, then it turns out that I can define a reduced process only for A, because the probabilities for the outcomes of the guys in the group A, given their settings, doesn't depend on the settings of the other of B. That's what it means that there is no signaling. So I can define that. And then you can introduce also this notion of a conditional process, which is just like a conditional probabilities to express the joint process. And then, okay, it turns out that we can prove the following theorem for the structure of these correlations, which obey causality, as I defined it earlier. And basically, okay, I'll just say roughly what it means. It's a kind of iterative formulation, which gives us a causal unraveling, gives us an interpretation of the process as describing some kind of causal unraveling. So, okay, I will not elaborate on the formulas that you see, but just to say how we can interpret them, it basically is like this. You can imagine that if a process is causal, it could be thought of as realized in the following way. Someone tosses a coin and we choose who is of the parties is going to receive a particle first, his system first. Then this party receives a system, performs an operation. There are some events in the laboratory. Then, conditionally on the fact that this party was first, conditionally on the event that happened in his/her laboratory, we toss another coin, perhaps which might be biased depending on what happened. We choose who is next. Then, conditionally on whatever happened in the first two, which is who's third, and so forth, and so forth. So, and this kind of gives us confidence that the definition that I gave earlier is actually a good definition, because at the end of the day, it gives rise to this structure of correlations that we can interpret in this way. And I think that this is, in some sense, the most natural notion of causality that we can imagine. I mean, it is exactly that. Each setting is independent of the past. But here the notion of past and future kind of arises from the correlations. Okay. Now, these causal correlations, they form polytopes. In the bipartite case, it has been characterized for the case of input and output bits by Bronsart. So there is a lot to be done with this. I'll just say that starting from this canonical decomposition of a causal process, we may now consider how to rigorously define what I was telling you earlier. Remember in the bipartite case, I said we're going to call this process matrices causally separable, which with some probability I can think that it's a channel with memory from Alice to Bob or a channel with memory from Bob to Alice, because intuitively we know how to implement them in practice using quantum mechanics. So now it turns out that actually if you consider this complicated looking canonical decomposition of a process in terms of conditional processes which are themselves causal and so forth, then we can define causally separable processes which generalizes this or extends it to the multipartite case in the following way. We simply require that each of these processes, conditional or reduced processes that appear in this causal unraveling, they are themselves valid quantum processes. And there is analogy with the way you might think there is a very particular analogy with Bell local states, those that have a local Hilbert variable description, and separable states, which are non-entangled. And as you know, they are not the same thing in general. Bell local states are not equivalent to separable states. And similarly here, as I mentioned earlier to you with the quantum switch, we have scenarios where you have a quantum process which is not causally separable, following this definition. Nevertheless, it is causal because it cannot violate any causal inequality. In fact, the causal inequality, if I go back, can be understood, as I said, these correlations, they form polytopes. And causal inequality is something like a plane, which, if you are on one side of that plane, you know that you are certainly outside of the causal polytope, so you must be violating causality in some sense. The facets of this polytope, they themselves define tight causal inequalities. All right, so I think, we have developed a pretty, kind of rich theory of these causally separable processes. We have found out that actually there are that this non-causality, violation of causal inequalities, can actually be activated. It turns out there are causally separable and therefore causal tripartite processes where if we supplement the parties with a shared entanglement, suddenly the process allows us to violate causal inequality. And this seems very counterintuitive, given that especially in this framework, we assumed from the start in the quantum process framework, we assumed that that this should come for free, the sharing a state, an entangled state is something that we assumed in the derivation. So this suggests that perhaps a sensible definition of causally separable is one which actually remains causally separable or causal under extension with ancillas. We call this extensively causal and extensively causally separable processes. And it turns out that we can find a simple characterization which generalizes the simple form of the bipartite case a simple characterization of multipartite extensively causally separable processes. It generalizes this simple thing that I described here to the multipartite case. All right, so a very nice and rich structure of different types of processes has emerged here, which we can use to study this phenomenon of indefinite causal order or violation of causal inequalities. It could also be used, I believe, to devise some tools for causal inference, where now we have gone beyond the paradigm of the causal order between Alice and Bob is fixed. But now we permit the causal order to be dynamical, to depend on the parties and so on. Okay, but as I said, this theory, which I think gives us very interesting insights into all kinds of, and raises also very many questions, is itself still asymmetric. If we come back to our initial motivation for this goal, where we would like to develop an understanding of quantum theory where causal structure is not assumed from the beginning, we might ask ourselves, okay, we still assume causal structure locally in some sense. We have this input and output systems, everything locally obeys quantum mechanics. Can we go beyond that? And there is a certain asymmetry, actually, which is rather troublesome. Depends. I mean, you might think that this time asymmetry, which is part of the description of a local operation, is something that is inevitable and every theory should have, but you might also be bothered by this. And so what is the origin of this time asymmetry? Can we understand it and can we drop it somehow? So this, to address this, I'm going to now forget about this process framework and go back to the formulation of quantum theory in the so-called circuit framework, which was introduced by Lucien Hardy and Kiribella, Dariano, and Perinotti in their reconstruction of quantum theory from operational principles. Basically, in this framework, which in some sense assumes a particular ordering because it is given by circuits, what you imagine is that you have different operations with input and output systems that you can compose in parallel and in sequence to form these directed acyclic graphs called circuits. And whenever you have a circuit with no open wires, that is how a circuit is defined, such a graph with no open wires, the theory prescribes joint probabilities for the outcomes of the different operations in these boxes. Quantum theory can be formulated in this language and even derived under certain assumptions. But in this language, we can see the asymmetry or at least one striking consequence of it in a very interesting way. And this is the so-called causality axiom. So causality can be formulated rigorously in this circuit framework, which gives us an order. Given this order, basically, which comes from the composition of operations, causality is formulated like as the property that consider a simple circuit like this with a single preparation and a measurement connected to each other. It states that the probabilities for the out, if you consider the joint probabilities that the theory prescribes for such an experiment, and you calculate the marginal probabilities for the preparation, they are independent of what measurement is plugged in here. And this you can easily see in quantum theory. These are a preparation is described by a collection of unnormalized density matrices whose sum is a normalized density matrix. And a measurement is described by a collection of positive semi-definite operators that sum up to the identity. So you can see that no matter what measurement I plug in here, if I sum up over the measurement outcomes, the preparation, the probability for a particular preparation outcome is independent. This was, I actually learned not long ago that the same property was identified by David Pegg also as causality. He calls it weak causality. In an earlier paper, actually. And yeah, it's a, I mean, if you consider a circuit, this really tells us that if you consider the probabilities for a given the outcome of an operation at some point in the circuit, it's independent of how you, what happens in the future. It doesn't matter how you complete this operation and you close the circuit in the future. It's always the same. But now, what is this property causality? I mean, is it something that we choose to, how to define quantum theory? Do we just postulate it as a way of, do we define it? Do we say, I'm going to choose to call a measurement something with this property because I would like my theory to have it? Or is it something that is really captures some aspect of the physical world which is carries a non-trivial content? I mean, in other words, does it correspond to some non-trivial prediction that we could in principle test? Well, to understand this question, we have to first ask ourselves, what do we mean by an operation? Because this thing, that the circuit framework, I mean, it is a statement about the joint probabilities of operations, but we never said what we mean. I mean, intuitively what we mean and how it has been defined in these approaches to quantum theory, it is one use of a physical device. That is how someone sets up the device and uses it. Okay, but of course, I mean, a device is a complicated thing and we would like to kind of decompose this idea into simpler notions such as, for example, variables, random variables that describe how I've set up my apparatus, for instance. And in this paper, we've addressed the question of this time asymmetry in quantum theory, and we identified there are two key ideas that enter in this notion of operation. The first one is what I call the closed box assumption. And this is basically the idea, to say it in simple terms, that an operation is something that you should be able to implement inside an isolated laboratory, just like in the process matrix framework at the beginning. And why is that? I mean, it is because this notion of a circuit is a pretty profound concept, actually, which I'd like to just with an example to illustrate what it is saying. Now, imagine that, you know, intuitively, the way you might think is this is just one use of a device. This is some sequence of devices that I'm applying, some sequence of operations that have happened to occur. But that is not exactly a circuit, because if I choose to perform this operation here, given, let's say, the outcome of this box, you see that the joint probabilities will be changed. They will be different from if I were to toss a coin that is totally independent of what outcome is produced here and I apply it. Because the fact that I have applied this is already telling me something about which outcome occurred if I had conditioned my choice on the past outcome. So you see that the probabilities are, you know, they are not, you cannot just define them even without specifying how you have chosen the operations. But, I mean, by definition, this thing is well-defined. And what the catch is in this argument is that basically if I had conditions, imagine this scenario where I condition the choice of operation here on the outcome here. If I want to describe it properly in this language, I should introduce an extra wire here, which describes the information about the outcome and enlarge my operation here, which conditionally on this information that comes out applies this or that. So again, I can include it in the circuit framework, but I would need to consider enlarged devices. So the idea of the circuit is that by definition, when you see this picture, this captures by definition all the means of information exchange between the different boxes. So if there was this extra thing, I would need to incorporate it. When I write it like this, I declare When I write a circuit like this, I declare that this choice of operation was somehow, the set of possible events that might occur in this region of space-time, if you wish, is correlated with the others only as a result of whatever information was exchanged through these wires. And this, I mean, one way of to say what it means is that we could, in principle, you should imagine that any operation that is a valid operation in the language of a circuit is something that you can do in a closed laboratory. Okay, but this is not all, and this doesn't tell us anything about the time asymmetry. So the second idea is that an operation, if you think about it as a set of possible events that might occur, is something that this set of possible events is selected. It is defined by the setting of the operation. And the setting of the operation is a variable that I know before I actually, or I can know before I actually apply the operation. In other words, the procedure of implementing a particular operation does not involve post-selection. You can choose your operation before you actually apply it. And in fact, this is, I believe, one of the reasons why we think that we can choose an operation, rather than the outcome of an operation. Intuitively, we say, I can choose to do this or that in my experiment, but I cannot choose the outcome. It's somehow the response of nature. But I believe the reason for that is that exactly the fact that I can know what I call the choice of setting before, whereas I can only know the outcome later in general. So if you take this point of view that by definition, you know, it's about what defines the setting is something that is available or can be available before you actually apply your operation on the input system, then you see that the causality axiom then describes a non-trivial constraint. It's not just a matter of our choice of how to define the theory, but it really is a non-trivial physical constraint, because indeed it tells us that if you consider all possible operations that you can realize inside closed boxes without using post-selection, they will be such that they will obey the causality axiom. It doesn't need to be the case a priori. And as I'll describe in a moment when I generalize the theory, it is logically possible that this is not the case, but it happens to be the case. At least for what we understand to be a closed and isolated laboratory, we can go and do the experiment and we find out that, I mean, without post-selection, we cannot implement anything that violates the causality axiom. So it's a non-trivial constraint, but it concerns operations which by assumption do not involve post-selection in their realization. And we see here that the very concept of operation is time asymmetric. And this is a little bit disturbing because, I mean, why would you formulate a physical theory starting with a fundamental concept such as operation, which is fundamentally asymmetric somehow? I mean, it is intuitive and natural because in practice, I'll come to that, but in practice, I think the reason for that is that we don't know the future and we are interested in predicting it. And we can know and we can set up in advance our experiments. So it comes naturally. But somehow, from a physical perspective or even purely information theoretic perspective, you would like to have a kind of symmetric start and maybe try to understand this physical asymmetry somehow. Now, say how we can understand it. So our proposal is to drop this assumption. Rather than define an operation as just a set of possible events that you can prepare inside a box without using post-selection, you don't declare that you shouldn't use post-selection. You say nothing about that. It's just a set of possible events that Alice, conditionally on her local information in the box, knows is occurring between the input and an output system. So in other words, we have simply permitted, at the moment, to understand simply what we're doing, we have simply permitted to use post-selection in how we define what an operation is. So I can use post-selection to construct any operation. Now this enlarges immediately the class of what we can call an operation, and you can easily see what it is. Actually, I will be quick, but basically what we relax, I mean before, a preparation was just described by a collection of possible, by a collection of, let's say, positive semi-definite operators that sum up to a normalized row. But before we had that, the measurement is described by a collection of positive operators that sum up to the identity. Now, since we have permitted post-selection, one can easily calculate what are the most general scenarios, and one obtains that a measurement should be described just by a collection of positive operators that sum up to some operator that we normalize, let's say, to have trace D. You can normalize to have trace one, you can normalize it anyway, but the reason why we normalize it is that if you look at the formula, I mean, if I multiply all these operators by a constant, nothing changes in the probabilities. So this is a degree of freedom that is irrelevant for the probabilistic predictions of the theory. So I gauge it out. I say, okay, this is irrelevant. We take equivalence classes. I mean, in this whole business, the notion of operation and this transformations that appear in the boxes, they are defined by equivalence classes with respect to the joint probabilities of all possible circuits. Now, this formula has previously appeared in the work of Pagan, Barnett, and Jeffers, who are interested in deriving some kind of retrodictive quantum theory. They also propose it as a fundamental rule, but they thought that this is a kind of, or at least they claim that this is an equivalent formulation of quantum theory. I would like to say that this is actually, it is more general. This is important, I think, to realize because it suddenly permits many more things that are not included in standard quantum theory. Because nothing in this formulation, I mean, implies the causality axiom. Nothing tells us that if we restrict to preselected operations, we should suddenly obtain only the operations of standard quantum theory. So the proposal is that this is the fundamental rule, and we can, one thing I would like to say is that about the concepts of states and effects in this theory. States are defined as equivalence classes of preparation events in the circuit framework. And similarly, what we call effects in standard quantum theory, these are usually just described by the operators E. They're equivalence classes because they click with the same probability. I mean, if two events click with the same probability for any preparation, I mean, you declare them to be the same measurement event. But here, if you look at this formula, you see that the equivalence class of preparation events are described by two operators. One is rho, and the other is this rho bar, which I declare to be the average state of a preparation that comes out of my preparation device using the standard language. And similarly, E bar is this the sum of the different operators. So really now we see that in this theory, the preparation events, the states of this theory are given by two operators, not a single operator. And we can think of states and effects as functions on each other by this joint probability formula. But then and we can declare that whenever the denominator is zero, for example, we can postulate that this joint probability is zero, just to complete the definition of the functions. Then, if you think of them as functions on effects and vice versa, you know, they are not closed. The state space is not convex. It's not closed under convex combinations. If you think of it as a function on the effects, you may consider the convex extension, you may consider the linear extension, because these functions, they live in some linear, trivially, in some linear space, but not all of them correspond to events that you can realize inside a closed box. So I'm saying this because it is often in the literature that you can find the, I mean, people refer to this as a nonlinear quantum mechanics, things like that, where you have the denominator. It is not as, well, depends what we mean. It is nonlinear in the operators of the original theory from where we started. But if you consider properly defining the new theory, I believe the correct statement is that simply this theory is not convex closed, but in principle, it could be embedded and linearized. We can embed the spaces. Okay, so we can consider and we can continue developing this theory. We have permitted pre and post selected operations, and now we expect that this new theory is somehow time reversal invariant. What do we mean by that? I mean, if I have some set of boxes, since I permitted to define them with post selection too, I mean, I can interpret the exact same experiment like this. I can just mentally flip the time orientation, and I can call this a preparation and this some transformation from B to A, and then I can call this a measurement. And again, I mean, this the joint probabilities should remain the same. But there are infinitely many transformations, actually, that obey this. So how do we describe time reversal? Well, time reversal is actually not something that is implicit in the theory. That is something I would like to stress, because sometimes, I mean, this I believe most of you actually know very well, but okay, there are some works in which, for example, the bra is called to be the time reversed image of the cat, which is not correct. So really, the way to think about time reversal is, I believe, should be in a physical sense. I mean, time reversal should be determined experimentally, in principle, I mean, as an active transformation in some sense. Of course, we cannot just time reverse something, but we can consider the following. Imagine a preparation box, a preparation device, which outputs several possible states, for example. I mean, the way we should understand it is that if I were to describe this experiment in a time-diverse order, I record it and I play the movie backwards, it will look to me as if it was some kind of measurement box. Now, I don't know what measurement this box implements. It just looks like a measurement box, but which quantum measurement is it? I mean, you define this relative to preparations that have not been time-reversed. So in principle, if you could create the time-reversed image of a preparation as some kind of measurement, and then you can go and test which measurement it actually is relative to preparations that you haven't time reversed. And this is by definition the time reversed image. So we have, you might ask, what form can it have? And in this paper, we have actually characterized all possible symmetries that are permissible in this time symmetric quantum theory. And I think that here I will not spend too much time, but I'll just perhaps say that one of the key insights, because we find that actually in this theory, there are more general symmetry transformations possible than in standard quantum theory. In standard quantum theory, symmetries, we believe, are given by Wigner's theorem, which says that they are either unitary or anti-unitary. However, in this time-symmetric theory, because we have this more general rule, the symmetry transformations that we can conceive are more general than unitary and anti-unitary. And this comes out if you properly realize that although we were using operators in the same space to represent the states and effects, we were using just positive semi-definite operators on a given Hilbert space, there's objects that live in separate spaces. So they're not the same object. So I think this is a good example of how, I mean, if you just get carried away by the mathematical representations and forget what these objects are supposed to represent in practice, you can make conclusions that are not necessarily warranted and can have pretty big consequences. Anyway, I'm just saying that these objects that we associate with preparations and measurements, we describe them by operators, but these operators actually live in dual spaces. We simply represent them using operators in the same space by choosing a bilinear form in the space of the states, for example. And in this way, this defines an isomorphism. But this is nothing but a choice of representation. So if we take this into account, we see that symmetries in this, in general, they should be like this, that symmetries are defined by two transformations. For example, we can distinguish two types of symmetries. We call type one the symmetries like rotation, where a preparation becomes under the rotation is again another preparation, and a measurement is still another measurement. But again, there should be two separate transformations that tell us how the state space transforms and how the effect space transforms. And type two symmetry transformations, which involve time reversal, for example, it is in this class, it flips under time reversal, the states become effects, and the effects become states. And again, the important thing to realize is that most generally, since these are separate spaces, although we represent them in the same space, these are separate objects, most generally we can have two types of transformations. So because of that, we obtain these more general types of symmetries, which extend Wigner's theorem. And I will not spend too much time on that. But basically, Wigner's theorem is recovered whenever this S is here on the states and effects are unitary. But they don't need to be unitary. And they are just some invertible operator, most generally. And time reversal, in particular, can be in this class. And the standard notion of time reversal that we have is recovered when S is unitary. Anyway, so coming back to this idea that causality is an asymmetric, is a physical asymmetry. It concerns something that in practice is a constraint, that we cannot implement operations that do not obey causality without using post-selection. How can we understand this? And we can actually, there is a way to reason. We can consider a toy model of the universe, and in order to capture the information that exists at different instances of time. And basically, in this paper, we have this argument that if you consider the information that exists, so here we have purified everything, we assume that the dynamics in time in the universe is unitary. Let's say some kind of toy quantum field theory model here. This means that basically all classical information that comes out as the outcomes of different experiments means if we purify the universe and consider all environments and devices, all classical information comes into the boundaries of this slice. And basically, you can see that all future, according to an observer here, in this box, in this part of the universe here, given all the information that exists up to this point, all the future circuits, conditional on the information it has, would consist of standard quantum circuits, that is, standard trace-preserving operations that obey the causality axiom, if and only if the future measurement here in the universe is a standard quantum measurement. So in other words, we can understand this fact that given the knowledge at present, all future, this is what it means without post-selection. That given the information now, my knowledge about the future possible events in whatever boxes here and effective circuits you can imagine, they are all standard operations that obey the causality axiom. It is because, you can think that this is the reason if you wish, but it is equivalent basically to saying that the future box in the universe has this form, the standard form. Okay, this is also linked, we can make an argument that this is also linked to the memory arrow of time, the fact that we don't remember the future, but we can have memory of the past. So you can make an argument basically having to do with the fact that if this is maximally mixed on average, all these events, they sum up to the identity, like all. This is very intuitive, but hand-wavy explanation. But basically, all systems that come in from the future are uncorrelated. Whereas if you put the observer up there, I mean, if this doesn't sum up to the identity, then you can conceive how different subsystems can be correlated with others. So as a result of what has happened in the past. So in that sense, we can say that we can have memory of the past. Okay, so we can understand this asymmetry as a result of boundary conditions. This is the message. So we don't need to take it as a fundamental rule in how we construct quantum theory, but we can assume this more time symmetric version of the theory, which doesn't say from the outset how things should be, what we can do with or without post-selection. And within that theory, we can still make sense of this fact. But now we don't regard it as a fundamental one. We kind of see it as due to boundary conditions. I would like to say that, in fact, it is totally possible and logically consistent to imagine situations where universes where this is not the case. Not only can we go beyond unitaries here or whatever, I mean, we can conceive anything, but it is totally consistent to imagine how an observer, let's say here, will have information about the future, which is, an observer here will say, oh, in the future here, I'm going to have an operation that is does not obey the trace preserving condition, and therefore, if it's part of some circuit, it's not going to obey causality. So in other words, he can prepare, if you wish, this operation without using post-selection, and this would not be a causality obeying operation, but it is still possible. All right, so now I think I've gone way beyond time, so I will just very quickly tell you what we have done. From this time symmetric framework, we can now go to a time neutral formulation of quantum theory, which eventually allows us to unify with the process matrix in a time symmetric fashion. And this time neutral representation comes from a novel isomorphism, which is similar to the Choi isomorphism I was showing earlier, but it depends on time reversal. With each wire in a circuit, we associate an entangled state. And this entangled state, in some sense, can be thought of as a physical and measurable state. And this comes from the idea of time reversal, meaning that, for example, if you think of this box here that you can flip it, time reverse it, and plug it here, this establishes, in principle, a correspondence between the two Hilbert spaces that I introduce at the two ends of a wire. And so I can, in principle, make sense of this state as a valid state. And these are now described by positive semi-definite operators as before. And we have this formula, which is now, we don't need to apply operations in an order. We can just, in this time neutral fashion, just use this formula where the W matrix here is just a tensor product of the wires. And these are positive semi-definite operators achieved through this isomorphism. I'm going to skip that. Now, this formalism allows us to think of circuits with cycles, too. So now it allows us automatically to consider more general possibilities. But I would like to mention that actually we can make an argument. This is related to the switch that I mentioned earlier, where conditionally on a control bit, maybe a quantum one, we can move. We can perform the operation of Alice before or after Bob, for instance. We can argue that from a particular point of view, we can see this as describing a circuit with a cycle. Here, this argument exploits a little bit the idea of background independence, but we extend it to random events, meaning that each event, there are no points in which events happen, but it is the event that defines a point. So I can choose, in principle, a coordinate system in which I put Alice here. But in one realization of the process of the experiment, I will have a situation where Alice is before Bob and I have a channel like this, or I have this channel. It's just that this region that connects the regions of Alice and Bob contains an event, which is either this channel or that channel. If I don't know it in principle, which channel it is, I would describe the operator here as a mixture of the two operators. Or more generally, if I was using a quantum bit, I can have a more general thing, which is not even a mixture. So this gives us a kind of conceptual framework, but I'm saying that this is a circuit with a cycle that we can describe in this formalism that doesn't require post-selection to be implemented. So we can interpret such an experiment as a genuine circuit with a cycle, which we can actually do in practice without needing to resort to post-selection. So this formalism already is more powerful and gives us a possibility to describe certain things that otherwise we need to describe in much more complicated fashion. And then Okay, we can equivalently obtain a process matrix. Now it is symmetric, and we just have in the previous expression that we saw for the process matrix, we have this denominator. And finally, what we notice in this formalism is that actually this, I was including here difference between systems of type 1 and 2, because I was assuming a local notion of time at each point, basically. But at the end of the day, the joint probabilities are independent of this assumption. So at the end, what we can do is we can simply drop this distinction between two types of system that I was carrying over from starting from the circuit framework. And the thing we obtain is this. We just have different regions, and the connection between different regions are described by entangled states that encode the symmetry of reflection. And we have this formula for the probability. So the way to interpret this is that we have different regions, and this is local information. This description of a set of possible events is conditional on local information. And what the theory does is that if you give me the local descriptions, you tell me how they are connected, it's going to give me joint probabilities for the events in such a network. And okay, this suggests a kind of boundary approach to even to quantum field theory, which has been proposed and advocated by Ueckel. I'll just finish with this slide where I will say that now we can go back and ask, okay, we forgot about causal structure and time. We obtained this description of regions that are connected to each other, but how can we account for the phenomenon of causal structure and time that we have in our everyday experience? And one suggestion is that perhaps, I mean, one possibility is that we can just introduce the metric as another quantum field. This is one possibility. But it seems very interesting to explore another route, which is that it might be that even if I don't include the metric as a specific, explicitly as a field, even just by looking at this timeless description of the operator closed in this region or in any other region, I might be able to recover the causal structure, because somehow this causal structure, which is basically corresponds to the light cones, I mean, it imposes certain constraints on the correlations that exist between different points on the boundary. Like, for example, here, I shouldn't be able to signal from, from here somewhere. From here, I shouldn't be able to signal here, for instance. And this kind of constraint should be somehow included in this region. So this kind of suggests a program towards understanding causal structure only in terms of this boundary description and properties of the correlations that exist between different points on the boundaries of different regions. So thank you for your attention. Yes.
Well, thanks for this great talk. It was really very fantastic. I have a question regarding this isomorphism thing.
Yes.
Is there any specific reason why you to assume that time inversion operation is given by one global choice of this isomorphism if it's arbitrary? In a way, like, can I consider that, like, you can perform, that you have, like, you know, local freedom for choice of the type of isomorphism that implements the time reversals?
Yes, and somehow, yes, in principle, I can imagine that time reversal is even time dependent, for example. Or it might be, probably this is what you're suggesting. Maybe the form of time reversal here is not the same as the one later. Is that?
Yes, precisely. I mean,
yes.
I would not even say later, but anywhere else in the network.
Yes, okay, in that case, yes. It could be. In principle,
here,
it could be. Yes. So the philosophy here, the general picture here is that somehow this state is given to us by nature, just like if I were to consider such a region, whatever is contained in a particular, if I consider the quantum field theory limit, let's say, whatever operator is contained in a particular region is in some sense given to us by the laws of dynamics. That is, I separate quantum theory from, on top of it, I see, in addition, the laws of dynamics. Quantum theory just tells us what can be in the different regions, how we would calculate the probabilities. But let's say there is an extra assertion that comes from the let's say, from quantum field theory, which will tell us, I mean, if you give me your space-time here in these regions, you have this and this and this dynamics expressed in this language. So somehow, when you go back to this network, it is similar that the connection between these regions, as I understand it, at least this is the vision that I have, we take it to be just given to us by the laws of dynamics or the laws of mechanics, but the theory a priori allows this to be any. A priori, this could be any entangled pure state here. Not even maximally symmetric, because as I said before, we found this more general characterization of symmetries, and the case in which time reversal is not given by anti-unitary, but some other anti-linear operator there, that would be correspond to a non-maximal entangled pure state. So all this is captured here. That's to say, the idea here is that time reversal is something that I can find out in principle, let's say that time was going this way, if I were to physically implement, if I take this and physically implement the flip, or construct another box which looks just like this box but kind of time reversed, then I should in principle be able to characterize what that state is. And it will tell me, you can view it as encoding time reversal in the way we constructed it, but at the end of the day, it should be viewed the other way around. Time reversal in this picture is something that is not even there. I mean, all where time reversal would be to flip this box and put it here. Now, assume that this is given to you. You can go and do it in the experiment. Then this establishes the fact that you can move things from this end of the wire to here, establishes a correspondence between these two Hilbert spaces. So I can, in principle, introduce a basis here and map it here through time reversal. And now I'm going to find out what this state is, in principle. If I could do this experiment, I could characterize this state by tomography, doing local measurements simultaneously here and here. And in that sense, this state is seen as a kind of physical thing out there that we find out by experiment. The theory only tells us what is possible, what structure these connections have and wires, most generally, but what it happens to be in a particular realization, in a particular region of the universe, is to be understood as something that we go and find out somehow.
But in a way, there is a statement that locally we don't know a priori that any operation has to be, okay, it's like too much negation, I'll try to put it otherwise. Like, for in any like local consideration of some local time flow, yeah, we don't know that, and taking some operation, we cannot claim this operation is irreversible, yeah? Somehow like all operations are considered to be a priori reversible in a way. Is it so? Like in a sense that like, because somehow like the sort of the direction of time is set up by exposed by checking the probabilities. Yes, it's not given a priori. Yeah.
Yes, in this picture there would be no a priori given any direction of time, but here, for instance, we might be able to recover, maybe not a direction even, but we might be able to recover a time axis simply by the symmetries of these operators that are inside the different regions. Now, here I have drawn an arrow, but this is for you who knows that this is time. But for me who doesn't know, all I know is that if I do tomography on this region, I'm going to find out some operator. And this I describe without any reference to time. And similarly here. But somehow, the symmetries of these dynamics might be sufficient to reconstruct this causal structure, and this will give me a time arrow, let's say, in this direction. But then the direction is something else. I understand the direction is coming from the, at least in this picture, it comes from the boundary conditions, as I was describing before. I mean, the future boundary condition, at least if we map our description of the quantum world in this language, we see that the future boundary operation is kind of maximally mixed. The future is unknown and maximally uncertain, whereas the past is not necessarily. And this introduces some kind of asymmetry, which we can use to choose a direction. But more generally, even this doesn't need to be the case. So then I don't know how we could choose.
I was asking because like when you go like to like discussions back in time, like about the foundations of statistics, electrical mechanics and association with this arrow of time there, mm-hmm. there's always this, the issue of, and you know, there's like people like Prigozhin trying to do it within statistical mechanics, and
yes.
they had also the sort of transition operators and, you know, time
mm-hmm.
they're trying to do like time reverse operators associated with like probabilities in both times, and like
mm-hmm.
some aspects of the formalism as well, not all, but like some. And the thing is that there always somehow this emergence of direction of time, even local, from kind of time direction, non-preferring system at the beginning, somehow always was cumbersome. Like details were always kind of foggy, and it was hard to get it out. And like the like fine grain analysis were showing that always there was something put by hand. And I'm not claiming that this is a problem here. I'm just saying that like it's always something like very gentle, and like I was interested to what extent, like, you know, how this, where are the intricacies of the framework here, like regarding this problem?
Yeah, well, okay, I'm not familiar with the details of Prigozhin's work and how it relates especially to this. I haven't studied that.
I also don't know, but they have some structures about this.
Yes. Well, it would be interesting to understand the relations, but as far as subtleties are concerned, I mean, I'm sure there are subtleties that I don't realize, but I see at least when it comes to this, I mean, to me, the biggest subtlety was about this, how to capture the idea that without post-selection, what we do is this, only these operations that have the standard form, and we cannot accomplish the more general ones that we could do with post-selection. And to me, this was the toughest problem, and somehow with this picture that I was showing, this one, I mean, I think this is the solution to that problem. I mean, at least in some sense, back to how, to what extent this is satisfying to this kind of interpretation and with boxes and so forth. But at least, this was the, I mean, how to capture what I can do without post-selection. I mean, it's, you need to speak about the information that is available at a given time. And for that, somehow I could, the only way I knew how to do it is to go to this picture of the universe. Otherwise, if it's an effective circuit, I can't represent it because every effective circuit is conditional on some information. And how do I know that the information I'm talking about is not something in the future? So I need to include everything that can carry information. And then,
So I had a question on your, you said at one point that the very notion of an operation sort of seems to have this pre-selection built into it.
Yes.
And then you had a box with a sort of arrow going through it. My question was, is the notion of pre-selection, there's an arrow, you have a system passing through the box, and that's one sort of time arrow.
Yes.
But then there's the notion of pre-selection,
yes.
and you might want to think of that as an arrow passing through one side of the box and coming out the other. Is it clear that those two arrows are tied together? That I choose certain settings in the past. Is that the same as the time arrow where I put a system in from the bottom?
The problem is that I don't know of any way of incorporating in a picture
mm-hmm.
the statements that this is a given operation is implemented as a without post-selection. But even if you say, if you introduce these arrows, I mean, I still don't know that what you're talking, I don't know how to know that what we're talking about is something that didn't use post-selection. So even if you introduce these arrows, like
is the post-selection, I mean, there's the system passing through and you have arrows on there and that suggests time. But the post selection, is that the same, is that with respect to that same arrow, or is it a different arrow? Sorry, because you have your outcome and what?
I assume that when we write a box, I assume that on the side, we have this time arrow. It's on the side somehow. Of course, it corresponds, I believe, to...
That's my question. How
do
you
put an output?
Because you also have the setting and the outcome.
I do.
It's kind of a different sort of notion of, I would say,
yes.
I think we're coming in from the side.
Yes, setting an outcome. However, I don't know how to say that what I'm not You see, we can imagine, let me, perhaps this might address a little bit. I'm not sure if I properly understand it, but imagine that we would like to say, without post-selection, what does it mean that without post-selection, I cannot implement, let's say, a projection on the state zero? I would like to capture this statement by some pictures. But you can imagine the following. I mean, imagine that I would like to claim now to you that actually there exists a way to do that. And how do I do that? Here, I'm going to, I claim that here somewhere there exists information that I'm going to project on zero. How do? I prepare a random bit, let's say, which is either zero, well, no, I just prepare something that says this will project on zero. I do. If it doesn't project, someone looks here, if it doesn't project on zero, so I perform measurement in the 0-1 basis. But if it projects on one, I abort the experiment, I post-select, I claim no. So I only keep those instances in which this is true. It looks as if I kept them like this, it looks as if information existed earlier somehow. But I use post-selection. But how do I capture that? I go in infinite regress. That's why I ended up with this. But I'm not sure if this really addresses the question. But I don't know how to, if I only write this, this is to me nothing more than introducing two quantum, this can be even a quantum system. Although we might call it a setting or an outcome, I can draw these arrows. This can be classical, this can be quantum, or I can just think of this as quantum again. But again, how do I know that what I put in that box was not achieved through post-selection? I think it is an assumption. Otherwise, and I claim that this assumption is what we make implicitly when we speak about, at least, I think, in most approaches to quantum theory. Implicitly, we think that. Otherwise, it is not going to be true, actually. If we permit post-selection, we can have these more general projections, and we don't regard them as valid quantum theory.
I think that's
yes?
I have a question about your generalized weakness theorem. I'm trying to understand the root of the difference between your theorem and the original one. It seems that you're saying that the S operator does not have unitary.
Yes.
So
let me find it.
Yeah.
Ah, it's here. Yes, for example.
Is the root lying in a place that for a quantum information-inspired framework, we include CP maps as transformations. And this doesn't have to be unitary, but in
no.
The old framework, okay.
Ah, CP maps, yes. They don't need to be unitary, but I thought you were referring to...
I guess in the original framework of Wigner's, every transformation has to be unitary, every physical transformation from the input state to the output state.
Okay, let me write Wigner's theorem. So basically... Wigner's theorem, it can be formulated like this. I mean, it basically says that, I mean, if you... So it follows a slightly different kind of old school exposition of quantum theory, where you say that, where you look at these things, like sci-fi, and the way you interpret this object is, you say this is a transition probability. Now, okay, in practice, if we go into this operational approach, a transition probability really means a conditional probability for a particular measurement event, let's say psi, projection on psi, to occur given that you started in phi here in the preparation, roughly like this. Now, first of all, these are, as I said, they are not even, we generalize this formula. This formula is the probability for the future outcome given, this implicitly assumes that you have done a measurement which can have psi as one of its outcomes in the first place. Right? So you're doing a projective measurement where one of the outcomes is psi and the others are some orthogonal ones. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you do a measurement in a different basis, this transition probability doesn't make sense because it's really implicitly assumed it's conditional on setup where you can get this transition. Now, we have a more general formula here. I mean, if I have to write this in terms of positive operators, as you now do with POVMs and density matrices, another way of writing this might be slightly more general, is trace of E, the outcome, rho. This is your outcome, which might be, in the special case of a projective measurement, it might be psi psi. And this is the special case of a deterministic pure preparation, can be phi phi. And that's just this.
So in the old framework, rho is restricted to be a pure state?
No. Well, this argument is performed there, but actually you can perform the same argument with mixed. It's not a problem. Okay. In the old framework, this is your main probability rule. In the new framework, the probability rule is actually like this. You have E rho divided by the trace, and here is this E bar and rho bar, more generally. So somehow, if rho is deterministic state, I have rho again here. I get rho bar. I use, to remind you what it was, we were saying here states are described by two operators, rho and rho bar. And what I mean by this is a normalized density matrix which comes out of my preparation device, and rho is a particular subnormalized density matrix corresponding to a particular outcome. I can put it an index I if you want. But forgetting about the index and just speaking of states, I just write this as the state. But because I'm permitting now post-selection in my measure, in the realization of my measurement, this is the general rule that we get. So this is one step. Even if you do this step, so let's say you go from this rule, through here maybe, to this rule, even here, if you assume that E and rho are elements of the same space, you're going to get Wigner's theorem. But actually, what happens, Wigner's theorem tells us what are the transformations that I can do on the Hilbert space, which will preserve this. The symmetry is defined as some transformation which preserves these probabilities. Now, we can argue whether this makes sense under time reversal, because under time reversal, it is not the case in general that we have this rule.
Wigner's theorem works for infinite dimensional systems. I guess the generalized one should also generalize.
Yeah, that would be nice if you can extend it. I don't know. I haven't, because the generalized theory even is not extended because of this D, this dimension that appears all over the place. I mean, I took a normalization and I carry it all over the place, and I assume that the Hilbert space is finite. And I mean, extending this theory to infinite dimensions, I haven't done it, and I think it would be very interesting actually to do. I mean, I think that one of the difficulties there will be how to deal with the normalization. This is an interesting question.
A related question about normalization. You have different normalizations for rho bar and E bar.
Yes.
The trace of E bar is D, and the trace of rho bar is 1.
Yes.
I guess that's a conventional difference. You can put square root of D to both.
Yes, you could do that.
Okay.
Yes. You could do that. It's conventional. I just chose it the same as in the normal quantum theory. In the standard quantum theory, you take the sum of the measurement operators is the identity, and the trace of the identity is D. So that's why I just took the same. But it's really common.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.